Morning. Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will C. Mann, and with me in the studio
is Hala Goris. Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners.
And I have to start out this morning with an apology. We had thought that we were going to have Norman Finkelstein on live to take your calls, but we unfortunately have had to shift to a pre-recorded interview. 4 a.m. this morning, we were able to change the schedule and do a pre-recorded interview. We're going to go to that very soon, but I want Hala to give our listeners a little preview of what we're going to talk about in the second half of this morning's program.
And before going to that, I have to tell you, listeners, that as of late last night, we thought that we had Norman Finkelstein on live, that there was a scheduling problem. Will got up before 4 this morning and recorded that interview. So that is what you'll be hearing for the first half of our program. For the second part of the program, we are going to be discussing the Jeff Merkley fiasco. We will have with us by phone Tom Nelson, a local attorney, and Zaha Hassan, a Palestinian-American attorney, to discuss this. And we do have to disclose, however, and we want to make clear that KBOO cannot endorse any candidate. And the radio programmers, people like myself and Will, will not on a KBOO program endorse or unendorse any candidate.
And so now we'll go to that interview from 4 a.m. this morning with Norman Finkelstein. I spoke with him first off about his speaking tour. He's going to be up in Olympia, Washington on the 8th of May, and I talked to him a little bit about what he's been speaking about around the country.
You've been doing a number of speaking engagements recently, and the theme is the coming breakup of American Zionism. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what motivated that kind of theme for a talk. What is it that you're describing in terms of a transition here in the United States in particular for this this ideology or this doctrine of Zionism?
The main motivation was I've noticed the last few years when I speak that there's been less and less dissent from members of the audience, and it got me to thinking exactly what's going on, and it's become pretty clear to me that Israel's position, or the defense of Israel has become more and more difficult in recent years, because the kinds of sources you can draw on to make a convincing argument regarding Israel's history, human rights record, and diplomatic record, it's now quite easy to draw on mainstream sources to demonstrate that Israel has been historically in the wrong, that Israel's human rights record is egregious, and that Israel's the chief obstacle to resolving the conflict. There was a time when you could only draw on pretty marginal sources or sources by marginal dissenters. But now one is able to refer to mainstream human rights reports. One is able to refer to world court decisions. One is able to refer to nearly unanimous votes in the United Nations to make one's case. And it's my opinion that The more Israel's record has become indefensible, the more American Jews have found it difficult to defend Israeli policy. American Jews are overwhelmingly liberal in their sentiments, in their politics, believe in the rule of law, and all the rest that liberalism means. And it's impossible to reconcile calling yourself a liberal with defending Israeli policy. And so it's my argument that Jews are now drifting away from Israel because its policies have become indefensible.
And do you think that this is within a certain part of the American Jewish Zionist community, if we can call it that, that part of the American community that, first of all, is committed to this this notion of Zionism?
I don't think American Jews were ever Zionist, and I don't see any need to invoke those sorts of labels. If you were a Zionist, the social critic Irving Howe once said, if you were a Zionist and you had enough money to pay for a one-way ticket to Israel, you would have been there. And if you didn't pay that one-way ticket, then you're not a Zionist. American Jews, for various reasons, found it useful to identify with Israel, and now they're finding it less useful.
So there's a sense in which, just as you say, this notion of Zionism, I know Jeff Halper often refers to the support of Israel as the most important, it had become the most important expression of Judaism here in the United States, and that had to change because it had these very pernicious effects in terms of this blind support for Israel and a lack of critical perspective on Israel. And it does sound as though what you're suggesting is that the Zionism really isn't the Zionism that that drove the settlement and the colonial intervention that was the State of Israel, that it took a different kind of form or expression here in the United States.
American Jews were not Zionists overwhelmingly for obvious reasons. American Jews made their decision in the late 19th century, early 20th century. Jews from Eastern Europe had a choice. They could have gone to Palestine. They didn't. They came in overwhelming numbers here. They made their choice to make the United States home, and they made their choice to seek out a better life here and not to seek out a better life in Palestine. And by after World War II, the kinds of investments American Jews made to the United States began to pay off. American Jewry has become by far and away the most prosperous, thriving, flourishing ethnic group in the United States. This is home. So they're not Zionist in any meaningful sense. After June 1967, they're not Zionist in any sense. Forget about meaningful sense. After June 1967, when Israel became the United States' strategic asset in the Middle East, and Israel proved to be a formidable military power, seemed to be defending the enlightened Western American values in the Middle East, there were certain benefits to be derived from identifying with Israel, certain kinds of personal gratification, ethnic gratification that came from identifying with Israel, and American Jews joined that bandwagon, and now they're getting off it.
You talk about this transition that took place after the Six-Day War in 67. Could you describe a little more how that transition took place, the transition of Israel to becoming a strategic asset for the United States? I mean, this is a phrase that comes up now and again, and especially within the context of explaining U.S. policy towards Israel and the whole debate over the Israel lobby. What is meant by this idea of the strategic asset explanation of the United States' relation with Israel?
Well, beginning in the 1950s, you had the phenomenon in the Arab world of Nasserism and Arab nationalism, and the United States didn't quite know how to deal with it. Sometimes they tried to placate Nasser. Other times they tried to use subversion and military intervention to undermine Nasserism in the Arab world, or to check Nasserism in the Arab world. Nonetheless, there was a kind of balancing act going on with trying to placate Nasser and placate Arab nationalism, which meant, in part, keeping Israel at arm's length, because one of the bogeys of Arab nationalism and of Nasserism was Israel. Although Nasser didn't really care that much about Israel until Israel tried very hard to provoke him into a war, and eventually they didn't succeed, so they just invaded in 1956. That was
an alliance with the British and the French, the Suez.
Yeah, what's called the tripartite invasion at the time of the Suez crisis. What happened was basically in 1967, Israel reduced Nasserism to minuscule proportions. They knocked out Nasser, and that was pretty much the end of Arab nationalism. And the United States derived from the 67 experience the lesson that we now have a strategic asset in the Middle East which can keep the Arabs in their place, and which was a formidable military force able to keep Arab nationalism at bay. And so then became the U.S.'s strategic asset in the Middle East. And at that point, that's when American Jewry discovered Israel. If you look at the record from 47 to, excuse me, from 50, 1950 to 1967, Israel disappears from the map of American Jewry, apart from as an object of charity. There's no interest at all in America, by American Jews in Israel. You could say 10 or 15% of American Jews expressed in one way or another some interest in Israel. But otherwise, it had just fallen off the map after Israel's founding, or fallen off the radar screen. And then after 67, it becomes a central component of American Jewish life. In large part, because it became a central component of American life generally, it was now no longer a risk to be pro-Israel. People forget all of these things because the history now is, 40 years has passed. But after Israel was founded, American Jews were very cautious about their support for Israel, in large part because they were fearful of this bogey of dual loyalty that they were going to be charged with. Jews have always had this burden of being charged with loyalty to their states and loyalty to international Jewry. And now you had a state come into existence which called itself the State of the Jews, which claimed the primary loyalty of Jews all around the world. Well, this is the last thing American Jewry needed, because it was now beginning to thrive. It's after World War II. The walls of discrimination are beginning to crumble. American Jewry is entering mainstream American life into the professions. And the doors to power and privilege have opened, and the very last thing they need now is to be charged with dual loyalty, because it's going to undermine their access to power and privilege in the United States. And it's only after June 67 that this dual loyalty charge pretty much disappears, because Israel has now been integrated into the network of U.S. power. And in fact, being pro-Israel is no longer dual loyalty, but it's super loyalty, because Israel is on the front lines defending U.S. interests, defending Judeo-Christian values, Western values, the Enlightenment, against the Third World Arab hordes. So if you're pro-Israel, you're pro the bastion of Americanism in a strategic area of the world. And in fact, Jews, unlike American GIs in Vietnam, the Jews are winning. So it was now a badge of honor. It no longer connoted dual loyalty to be pro-Israel. It was now connoted super loyalty to the United States.
Do you see the current reemergence of this whole question of dual loyalty perhaps finding expression in the debate over the Israel lobby, in the tremendous controversy over the Mearsheimer World?
Yes, I think that there has been serious concern among American Jews that this Israel's feverish support for the attack on Iraq, and now its feverish support for the attack on Iran, the first already being a debacle, the second one being possibly a debacle times two or more, is creating problems for American Jews. And American Jewry, it's, in my opinion, largely due to that, that of all ethnic groups in the United States, American Jews are now by far and away the most opposed to the Iraq war and calling for a full withdrawal. It's up to about 77% of American Jews calling for full withdrawal. And American Jews, by, I think it's the last poll showed, 60% oppose an attack on Iran, even if Iran has nuclear weapons. And I think it's because American Jews are fearful they'll be blamed if the war goes south.
Now, that's a broad swath of Jewish American opinion on these issues. But in terms of the what we might call the institutional expression of Jewish opinion through the...
That's correct. Organizational expression is very different than the actual opinion of American Jews. But that's because the organizational expression has always been skewed. The organizational expression, you have two kinds of Jews. You know, this is very rough, but it's not inaccurate. You have liberal Jews who give to many causes in terms of money and the investment of energy to many causes, because part of being liberal means that you're going to care about the state of humanity. And then you have the extreme right-wing Jews who give to one cause, and that cause is Israel. And what happens is those who are fanatically committed to Israel in a unidimensional way, or in a singular way, because of their fanatical commitment, both in terms of time and in terms of financial support, they end up dominating the Jewish organizations, because the Jewish organizations, at one level, they've always been in the American Jewish community. They've been controlled by people with money. In that respect, they're very different than, say, for example, African-American political organizations, where you don't have to be a billionaire, or at one time a millionaire and now a billionaire, in order to be the head of, say, the NAACP. There's no correlation between wealth and leadership. But in the American Jewish organizations, it's pretty obvious to anyone who just looks at the lineup, whether it's an Edgar Bronfman or a, his name just slips my mind, or a, you know, all of their names slip my mind. I'm not particularly fond of them. All of the heads, Ronald Lauder, what's the one who's the owner of, he used to be the owner of the U.S. News and World Report.
I'm not really sure, actually.
You have to be in the a very upper tier of wealth in order to control the organization, or in order to lead the organization, or you have to be fanatically driven in order to be organizationally well-positioned. You know, in the in the bureaucracy of these organizations. And so what consequently happens is it's the right-wing Jews who tend to control all these organizations, but they're not representative of American Jewish opinion at all.
You've mentioned, I just want to clarify something, you've mentioned that there is this concern within the broader Jewish community about being accused of dual loyalties.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't necessarily motivate the politics of this broader Jewish community in its opposition to...
I think it's part.
You think it's a part? You think it is,
think
actually...
Part of it is they're liberal. And if you're liberal, you give peace a chance. Whereas Israel's motto is effectively, and not being facetious, its motto is give war a chance and another chance and another chance. So if you're liberal, you have a problem with that. So part of it is being liberal, but part of it is, as you mentioned earlier when you framed the question, part of it is the resurfacing now of the dual loyalty problem.
Now, I want to go back just briefly because I think this is something that's illuminating or at least raises a number of additional questions about the whole strategic asset understanding of the relationship with Israel, and that is the relationship between Britain and Israel and France and Israel prior to the Suez War and that how that alliance developed. There was a sense in which Britain and France made a similar assessment about the asset that Israel represented in terms...
No, not really. No, it was entirely different. Yeah, look, in the case of Britain, Britain's main concern in the Arab world were, or the Middle East, were the Arab nations. And there was no love lost between the British and the Israelis after the end of the British mandate. And Britain was much more concerned about places like Egypt and Jordan, Iraq, where it's where all of its investments and military power was focused. So Israel didn't figure at all in their thinking as a military asset. In the case of France, basically what happened was once the Algerian War breaks out, in the Algerian War of Independence, the French get it into their head, it's not really true, but they think that Nasser is behind it, and that Nasser has to be, if Nasser is knocked out, then they will be able to be victorious in Algeria. At that time, the French were carrying out a brutal counterinsurgency, it was a murderous war in Algeria. About probably at least a million Algerians were killed by the time the war ends. And because the Israelis were had Nasser in their gun sight, there was a de facto alliance between the French and the Israelis, and the French were the main supplier of Israeli weapons, and at the time also, you know, the French were subsidizing or began the subsidy of Israel's nuclear weapons program. So what happened in 1956 was a marriage of convenience. The British needed a pretext to knock out Nasser because he had not just because he nationalized the Suez Canal. That wasn't the big issue. They just thought that Nasser was undermining British interests in the Middle East overall, and he needed to be, as Anthony Eden put it in March 1956, Nasser needed to be gotten rid of. The Israelis want to get rid of Nasser because they see Nasserism and Arab nationalism as a potential threat to their control of the region. The Israelis have this notion that they're a potential superpower, and they're of course the chosen people, and they should be in charge the Middle East, they see Nasser as a potential threat to their hegemonic ambitions in the Middle East. And the French see Nasser as the brains behind the Algerian war. Now, well, not just the brains, I should say, that he's the also the instigator, the orchestrator of the Algerian war, which is complete nonsense, by the way, but that's what the French believe. And so there was a marriage of convenience, and then they developed this very clever strategy that, or they thought was clever, that the Israelis would attack Nasser, then the French and the British would give Nasser and the Israelis, theoretically the Israelis, an ultimatum to move 10 miles away from the Suez. Of course, the Israelis would agree to it. Of course, the Egyptians wouldn't. And then there would be grounds to topple Nasser. But it had nothing to do with strategic asset. It was a marriage of convenience.
Were there other nations that were involved that had a supportive kind of relationship with Israel?
Not really. There were people. You know, Israel was able because it has a wonderful public relations industry. Next to Israel, you know, Cecil B. DeMille pales by comparison in terms of being able to sell itself as a commodity. And so there was, you could say, a reservoir of sympathy for Israel around the world, no matter how egregious its actions were, and no matter how belligerent and bellicose its leadership. But you couldn't really say it had any vital backers in the world. They were basically dependent at that point on the French, and using the Jewish lobby in the United States to get some extract some concessions from Eisenhower. They were more successful with Truman, but in general, quite limited in their power.
You take a somewhat more nuanced view of this role of the Jewish lobby, or what's sometimes called the Israel lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about this idea that it does play a very significant role, especially with respect to the United States' support of, or toleration of, or indulgence of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think one has to distinguish between, so to speak, local issues in the Middle East and then the broader region. On local issues, by which I mean the U.S., the Israel-Palestine conflict, I don't think there's any, there's no convincing argument, in my opinion, that it's motivated by U.S. national interests, or that U.S. derives any particular interest from Israel's colonization of the occupied territories, settlement of the occupied territories, and so forth. And in general, you know, you can't count on every action of the U.S. administration. But in general, I think it's accurate to say that the U.S. Has opposed Israeli expansionism at the expense of the Palestinians and the settlements program and so forth. And that it's basically been the lobby which has held the U.S. administration in check and enabled Israel to extract support from the U.S. government for its settlement activities, its colonization, and for its repression of the Palestinians. But when you get to the region, broadly speaking, where the U.S. has critical interests, whether it be Iraq, Iran, and so forth, there I think it's nonsense to claim it's the lobby that's the determinant factor. When U.S. critical interests stake, the U.S. administration is perfectly prepared to put Israel in its place. And everybody else quickly falls in line. When an American president says our national security is at stake in this or that particular instance and makes a forceful case, a determined case, that our national interest is at stake. The Congress quickly falls in line, notwithstanding the Israel lobby. And American Jewry quickly fall in line. It's like any other lobby. You recognize your limits. And within a certain sphere, you do have power. There's no reason to doubt the lobby has power. The gun lobby has power. And it undermines, in my opinion anyway, significant interests of Americans. And you could see, even the gun lobby was able in its own way to shape the presidential election with the comment by Barack Obama, which he had to quickly retract about, bitter workers clinging to their guns. And then, out came pistol-packing Sally, Hillary Clinton, talking about how, since she was a child, she was killing Indians. So it's not, surprising that the Israel lobby should have a good chunk of power, but within a sphere, not when it comes to fundamental U.S. interests. Once those fundamental interests come into play, the U.S. knows, U.S. ruling elites know how to put Israel, its lobby, and Jews into place.
Now, this idea, though, of the Israel lobby playing a key role, and in particular, I think, the association with the so-called neocons, the fact that we have so many of these neocons, very prominent policy advocates who are Jewish and have been explicitly, I think, accused of, if not dual loyalties, perhaps even very clear unipolar loyalties, and those loyalties are towards Israel.
Well, I think that's complete nonsense. I mean, these things are said, but there is no evidence to support any of these claims. Neoconservatives have two fundamental characteristics. They're complete opportunists, number one, and number two, they're complete thugs. In the fancy language, it's called believing in the use of force as against diplomacy. In layperson's language, they're hoodlums. And so they're opportunists. You take the highest profile neoconservative, namely Paul Wolfowitz. Wolfowitz was in every U.S. administration for 30 years, apart from the Clinton administration, when he was at Johns Hopkins University. He was as comfortable in a Jimmy Carter administration as he was in a Richard Nixon, in a Ronald Reagan administration. He made an easy transition from Carter to Reagan. These people have no principles. They have no, they have no ideological principles other than being wedded to power, and there's you could say there's marginal distinctions in the in people's willingness to use brute force versus diplomacy, and within that range of marginal distinctions, the neoconservatives fall at the end of the spectrum, which tends to want to use brute force. And it happens that that's Israel's mantra. The Arabs only understand the language of force. So it's not surprising that these neoconservatives would tend towards supporting Israel, not because it's Jewish, but because it's a thuggish state. And these people are basically thugs, or more thuggish than your run-of-the-mill ruling elite. But there's no loyalty to Israel. They have no loyalty to anything except themselves, to power, to privilege. And the very notion that these people are loyal to Israel gives them so much more credit than they deserve, because it makes it out that these people actually are wedded, committed to an idea, to a principle, that they have an ethnic loyalty, that there's an element of, as it were, idealism in their a moral and mental makeup. There's no idealism. These people are hoodlums.
Now, you had also written, I think, or at least spoken about, in particular, I hope I'm getting my neocons straight here, Norman Podhoretz,
mm-hmm.
and his writing an autobiography, I believe, prior to the Six-Day War, and then a shift that took place in his thinking.
Yeah, you read, I don't know how old you are, but in my generation, one of the famous books was a book by Norman Podhoretz called Making It, in which Podhoretz boasts about his success, early success in the United States at a very young age. He's the editor of Commentary Magazine, the flagship publication of American Jewry. And so he writes his vulgar book, because he's always been a vulgar slob, called Making It. By coincidence, it comes out a month or two before the June 1967 war. And if you look at the book, there's one mention in passing of Israel. He mentions that the founding editor of Israel, of a commentary, a fellow named Elliot Cohn, that Elliot Cohn clashed with the American Jewish community on the issue of Israel's founding in 1948. Apart from those one or two sentences, there's nothing on Israel. They have no interest in Israel. And it's very revealing that it's not only Norman Podhoretz, who's considered the godfather, along with Irving Kristol, of Jewish neoconservatism, but in a book that's titled Making It, he doesn't mention Israel, because Israel was not part of how you made it in the United States back then.
The remainder of that interview will be available online at the KABU website and at pdxjustice.org if you want to tune in. And, of course, you can find out about more about Norman Finkelstein's work at www.normanfinkelstein.com. He's going to be up in Olympia, Washington on May 8th. But we are going to transition right now into this other very pressing and local topic.
Yes, because we don't have a lot of time left, and we have two people, Zaha Hassan and Tom Nelson, with us, I will continue to explain what happened, just a description, and then we will ask for their views and what occurred from their perspectives. Jeff Merkley came back to my office November of 2007. I did not seek him out. He came to my office asking for my support for his Senate campaign. I expressed to him and reminded him again about the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and that my view is that the Democrats were really no better than the Republicans on this issue, and that when they get pressure by AIPAC, they fold. Merkley again expressed his view that he had first knowledge of Palestinian suffering in the occupation, that he had... that he was there and saw what was happening to Palestinians in the West Bank. I went ahead and contributed the maximum under federal law. And then he asked me to host a fundraiser in my home for him, basically focusing on getting the Arab American and Muslim American support for Merkley. I hosted that with Zaha Hassan, a Palestinian-American attorney, and we had raised a significant sum for him at that House fundraiser. We fast forward then to March 20th, when I received a call from Noah Gittel from Mr. Merkley's campaign asking for an emergency meeting with Mr. Merkley. And we decided that my earliest opportunity was that very next morning at 8 a.m. before my office opened. Mr. Merkley came to my office. In fact, he was waiting for me when I went up to my office. And I went in, we sat down, and I asked him what was going on. And he had tears in his eyes and said to me, "I have to give you your donation back." When I asked him why, he said, "You had made a statement against Israel. You had made a statement calling Israel terrorist at a rally in 2006. So I said, "Jeff, why don't you hold on? I have that very short speech I gave. I'll print it for you and show it to you." I did print it off. I handed it to him, and he read it. In response, he said, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing or the wrong thing. I want to win. I was quite shocked by that. We left it at that, and several days later, I received the check in the mail from his campaign. So they wrote a check to me for $2,300. It came folded in a plain white paper, no letter, nothing, no note, just back to my home. I then met with community leaders from the Arab and the Muslim community. These are not pro-Palestinian activists. These were community leaders. And when I told them what had happened, they were quite shocked. They main concern for several of them was that that our community should not feel like they cannot participate in the democratic process without a politician caving into AIPAC.
Yeah, and in particular, I think one of the questions that was raised was, is there a similar screening going on of contributors who may have made and who may very likely have made very inflammatory anti-Muslim remarks, anti-Palestinian remarks? Was there a similar screening going on? And just as you say, I mean, I've heard you speak so many times, Hala, and to suggest that any of your statements are not within what I would consider the legitimate mainstream. In fact, there's, I think, a moral imperative to make these kind of criticisms of the state of Israel and the U.S. relationship. It's astonishing that this would be this would come up as an issue. But I wonder if we should go to our guests on the line.
We will do that, but I'm going to fast forward because there were things that did not end up in the Oregonian article or the Willamette Week article. I will allow Zaha to fill in the information about the forum at the Middleman Jewish Community Center. However, I want to fast forward to this private meeting we had with Mr. Merkley last Friday. We had with us Brandon Mayfield, who, as you know, had been arrested and accused of being involved in the Madrid train bombing. And when Jeff explained that his campaign advisors had looked up any statements I had made publicly and had been advising him for months to return my contribution, and he didn't want to. Mr. Mayfield said to him, now, have you also looked up all of your campaign contributors for their anti-Muslim and anti-Arab statements that they may have made? And Mr. Merkley's response was, I don't know. He had with him at that meeting John Isaacs, who, as you know, is his campaign manager and had worked with the Democratic Senate Selection Committee, Mr. Schumer, or Senator Schumer. And John Isaacs wanted to make clear to those of us in the room, about eight or nine of us, that this was not something that was coming from the outside, pressure from the outside, meaning Schumer or the Senate Selection Committee, that this was really a local decision that was made. At that point, I took the opportunity to repeat to Mr. Merkley his statement to me in private. And I said, Jeff, when you came to my office, you said to me, you do not know whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing, but that you want to win. And there was absolute silence and no response. Everyone in that room heard that. Nofal Kasrawi went on record in the Oregonian, being interviewed by the Oregonian, saying that is what happened. He stayed silent. He didn't say, no, that didn't happen. Others also confirmed that for the Oregonian. Let's go ahead and go to Zaha first. Zaha, do you want to tell us about your relationship with Jeff Merkley going back several years?
Yeah, actually, I got to meet Jeff back in 2000 when the World Affairs Council was doing a speaker series that included Ehud Barak, who was the former Prime Minister of Israel, Madeleine Albright, and Thomas Friedman. Those were three of, I think, the four speakers in the series. And I had met with Jeff to ask him to open up the World Affairs Council to other perspectives that weren't being heard. And I'm speaking of a human rights or a Palestinian perspective, because those three speakers in particular were very much singing the same song when it came to Israel and the the blame that was associated with the failure of the peace process at the Camp David talks that Clinton, President Clinton, hosted. And he was willing to go ahead and do that. And I worked with him to secure Hanan Ashrawi to come to Portland to speak. And I was very impressed that he would take into consideration providing a forum for other views on the Israel-Palestine question. And later on, he also had been provided an opportunity through Project Interchange, which is an arm of AIPAC, to travel to Israel. And when I learned about this, I asked him if he wouldn't consider also taking a side trip to the West Bank and meeting with Palestinians and hearing from Palestinians and seeing how Palestinians live and what the occupation has meant for Palestinians and what the issues are in terms of settlements and the colonization of Palestine. And he agreed at that time, too. And there was a lot of pressure on him not to take this trip, and his trip was almost canceled. So he impressed me with the fact that he was willing to go at a time when Israel was invading, I should add, it was invading Bethlehem and other parts of the West Bank. He agreed to go and take that risk that was there for him to go at a time when it was politically unstable there.
Zaha, did he describe for you what he observed in the West Bank?
Yeah, he did, and he was very, I could see from what he was telling me about his experiences there that he was very shocked to see what he saw. It was a very different place from what he had seen when he traveled there as a college student. He had stayed with Palestinians as a college student as well during a trip to that area. But things had deteriorated and changed to such a degree that I think it was very shocking for him to see what he saw. And so he came back and he did some presentations for the community and for the World Affairs Council's board when he came back. So, I had high hopes for him in terms of what he would bring to the Senate seat, that he was vying for in terms of foreign policy knowledge, especially in the region of Israel-Palestine. He had much more information and firsthand knowledge than our current Senator Smith has. So that is why I was very interested in his candidacy and decided to support him and co-host a reception with you for him at your home.
And did you, this Israel position paper, did you talk to him about what would be in that paper? Did you ask him to?
Yes, this is the thing. Even before, he had called me as well about supporting his campaign early on, and I had asked him for a position paper at that time, and he said he was preparing one. And before we hosted the party, I was contacting his staff to ask for a position paper on Israel-Palestine. I wanted to see something in writing to get a sense of where he was going with the foreign policy aspect of his campaign, and I was told it wasn't complete yet. So I hadn't been able to get a copy of this position paper at all until the candidates forum that was being held at the Jewish Community Center, which was...
This was a week ago Monday.
It was, I found out about it and just, decided that...
How did you find out about the paper?
Through the Jewish Review.
Okay. Now, the position paper was actually handed out at the Middleman Jewish Community Center.
Right.
And although you had asked for that paper numerous times, you had called to get his... views on what he was going to put in that paper, you were told it was not complete, but it shows up as being complete
for a mostly Jewish audience. Right, and that was the first time I'd ever seen it or ever heard that it was complete, was at that event. And it was very distressing for me to see it because, first of all, it has no mention whatsoever of any of his experiences at all going to Palestine. His trips to the West Bank, the two trips, he doesn't mention that he had the experiences that he shared with me there, of crossing checkpoints, of seeing the suffering and seeing the oppression. It's not at all in there. The paper is very much from the perspective of, you know, Israel first, and Palestinians, and the Palestinian situation is seen more as a problem.
You could not make that Friday meeting. He was asked about that position paper at the Friday meeting with the 8 or 9 people there, asking him about his position paper, and his response was, the far right wanted me to put in much worse things in that position paper.
The far right of the Democratic Party?
Well, that's a good question. He said the far right wanted me to put in that the U.S. Embassy should be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and I refused. My question to him was, why are you negotiating with the far right? He did not have an answer.
Well, this is really the crux of the problem, in my view, is that, you know, instead of having Oregon constituents talk to elected officials or candidates about where they see, you know, foreign policy or how they see foreign policy and where the U.S. should be on issues, they're taking their dictates basically from outside of Oregon. And coming from really the conservative wing. If there's a conservative wing in the Democratic Party, then that's where it's coming from, because this is not part of mainstream Oregon Democratic viewpoints. I've participated in the state conventions, and I've seen been a part of passing resolutions related to Israel-Palestine at the state convention, and people are much more progressive thinking on these issues than you would think when you look at Jeff Merkley's position paper. It does not reflect the views of Oregon Democrats.
In fact, at the Middleman Jewish Community Center, Mr. Merkley's opponent, Steve Novick, had portrayed a much more moderate position on Israel-Palestine, and he received resounding applause from the crowd. So that was an interesting observation.
Right. Twice he had mentioned, when he mentioned Palestinian rights and Palestinian suffering and Palestinian self-determination and the two-state solution, he received applause. Did not receive applause during his entire presentation.
Yeah, I think we need to point out, though, that Mr. Novick does not have a position paper formalized yet on this issue.
Actually, he does have a position paper, but it was prepared prior to, I think he prepared it very early on, and it's posted on the website, I think at this point, auphr.org, the website. It is more of a sense of his feelings towards Israel as a Jewish American, more than really a discussion of the issues.
Yes, Zaha, if we can move on to Tom, because we don't have a lot of time left.
Yes.
Are you still with us, Tom?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Tom Nelson, great to have you on the show.
3 minutes. What are the key elements of this position paper that we should be most concerned with?
Well, I printed it out again this morning, and the elements, the problem I have with the position paper is it just goes down the line, 100% endorsing what Israel does, what Israel has done, and absolutely neglecting any consideration of the harm to the Palestinians that has been resulted. He talks about his personal connection to Israel, his trips there, his strategic relationship. He comes on really strong when he talks about threats to Israeli security. He sounds a lot like John McCain when he talks about Syria and Iran, talking about how Iran is a major threat to Israel, and therefore, for that reason, the United States has to be terribly involved in what happens. He talks about Syria and Hezbollah and Hamas. He says, quote, I support a tough and deft diplomatic strategy to keep Iran free of nuclear weapons and Syria under check. Well, that's not very far from where McCain is, and certainly is exactly where President Bush is. It goes on and on. He talks about the roadmap for peace, the Israeli-Palestinian relations. He says that the present conflict between Israel and Palestine has to be resolved, but then he comes up with with no real insights or no real suggestions other than to say, hey, the roadmap that President Bush put forth is really the best thing that we've had, when it's obvious that a two-state solution, unless there's some radical revision of the boundaries and removal of the settlements, the two-state solution is dead on arrival. The problem I have with the man is he knows these things. He's been there firsthand, unlike Gordon Smith. Gordon Smith's never walked in Palestine, to the best of my knowledge. Merkley's been there, and he knows these things. And in light of that knowledge, even in the face of that knowledge, when some pressure is put upon him, he caves. And that really raises a character issue for me. That's why I'm so terribly upset and disappointed in how Merkley has caved in on this issue.
You know, we are very fortunate this morning because we're going to be able to go over our usual scheduled time, and this couldn't be a more important conversation. I want to talk about one specific element that leapt from the page of this policy statement, and that's this final paragraph on the security barrier. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that. And maybe I could just read this. It says, Israel, like all other countries, has a right and the obligation to defend its citizens. Israel, after suffering over 1,000 dead and 7,000 wounded from suicide bombings and other terrorist attacks, responded by erecting a defensive barrier. This barrier has been successful in significantly reducing the number of terrorist bombings inside Israel. Anybody who's familiar with what is more properly called the apartheid wall, or perhaps the land grab wall, would find this paragraph so disheartening and so disappointing. And I want to say, first off, that I continue to have tremendous respect for Jeff Merkley. I have known him for many years. He has acted out of principle and in a very forthright and honest way. I first got to know him most intimately on issues through my advocacy for freedom for East Timor. And he both in his work at the World Affairs Council and in the Oregon State House, behaved with tremendous, I think, courage and principle and forward to a resolution and a coming together after this very, very sad and disappointing fracture in what I think should be a very strong relationship between a progressive politician like Jeff and, I should say, also progressive politicians like Mr. Novick and the other candidates who are involved in this race and the broad Arab-American, Palestinian-American, Muslim-American community. And we can even drop the hyphenated American part of that. So I hope we continue this conversation with the idea that we're moving towards a better place to be. Would one of our guests like to comment on this security barrier paragraph?
Well, I think all of us have seen it. Zaha, do you?
Well, I mean, if you read the paragraph again, you know, it's as though, well, you know, Jeff didn't travel to the West Bank during the time of the construction of the barrier. I think the barrier started I shouldn't call it a barrier, really. I'm starting to use the lingo of the thought police. But, Jeff didn't travel to the West Bank when that was being constructed. I think it was constructed in 2002. Construction began 2002. He was not there at that time, but he should know very well what the wall has, what it means, what it has been.
Not only should Zaha, but he actually had conversations with me about the wall.
Yeah.
And what it has done to Palestinians, separating farmer
and
from his farmland.
And where it's being built. I mean, it's not being built on the 1949 armistice line between what is considered Israel proper and what's considered the West Bank. It's built well within inside the West Bank and bringing in large tracts of land that belongs to and is owned by Palestinians. And the aim is to create facts on the ground, to incorporate Jewish colonies that have been illegally constructed in the West Bank, and to bring them into Israel. And every Israeli prime minister has recognized that the point of the construction of the wall is not for security, though that's what they say to the outside world. I mean, they are blunt about recognizing that this is going to be the boundary that for the you know, for the state of Israel, because at this point we don't have a declared boundary by Israel. Israel has never declared its boundaries, but this wall is going to be the boundary that Israel establishes.
Listen, Jeff Merkley knows the International Court of Justice ruled that this wall was illegal, violated international law. And so for him to call it a security barrier and that it was in fact built in response to bombings and not built to steal Palestinian land, not built to steal Palestinian water, the aquifers, not built to turn Palestine into Bantustans, for him to take that one very right-wing AIPAC position is just plain shocking. And in the Oregonian article, he admits that basically AIPAC wrote this for him, even though it says paid for by Jeff Merkley for Oregon. He says AIPAC wanted him to write this, and I assume when he says the far right wanted him to, he's talking about AIPAC and the local contingent of AIPAC. Tom, do you have anything to add to that?
Only that I was in Israel, Palestine about 3 weeks ago, and the wall is it's pretty much completed. And where there isn't a wall, there's a reinforced barbed wire fence, electronics all over the place. But the point I want to make is not only is the wall has it wreaked enormous damage on the daily lives of the Palestinians, and as you've already mentioned, it's a serious land grab and not just land but resources. In further impoverishing the Palestinians, the number of settlements that are in the West Bank, compared to just a year or two ago, it's drastically increased. I was up in Nablus, and everywhere you look, there's a settlement on a hill overlooking the town. Maybe you can claim ignorance, but I don't think so. Anybody that wants to know these things about Israel Palestine, all they have to do is go to any decent news source, or better yet, to the web, and start digging about the current events there. But none of these facts figures in his position paper, except to say, hey, the security barrier, as he calls it, is a great thing,
and also that the Jewish state of Israel should have Jerusalem as its capital.
Right,
and to me, that's really a very troublesome statement that he has in there. A Jewish state with Jerusalem as its capital. Now, when you say a Jewish state, what are you saying to the 23% of the citizens who are Palestinian? Are you saying, I mean, what is the meaning of recognizing a religious state?
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We are at the end of our time. Thank you very much, Zaha Hassan and Tom Nelson, for joining us this morning. Thank you, Hala, for bringing this issue to the attention of our listeners today.
And thanks to our listeners and to Will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in to One Land, Many Voices. Thank you.